Please be seated. Good morning, everyone. I'll have you call the first case, if you would, please.
Calling case A18-1605, State of Minnesota Respondent versus Eric Jerome Pratt, Appellant.
And we understand everything is operating smoothly. We have counsel for appellant arguing here in St. Paul in the Centennial Building and counsel for respondent from St. Louis County. And could you just say good morning or in some way counsel for respondent so we can just... Are you counsel for respondent?
I'm counsel for appellant.
That's what I thought. Okay, so counsel for respondent, can you just speak so we can have the camera pull your image up?
Good morning, Gary Bjorklund, St. Louis County Attorney's Office for respondent.
Great, okay, thank you so much. Just want a confirmation that we would have you in place when it's your opportunity for argument. All right, well, having said that then, we will ask counsel for appellant to begin. Please go ahead, sir.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Adam Lozo, and I represent the appellant Eric Pratt. The state charged Eric Pratt with two offenses: first-degree sale of a controlled substance and third-degree sale of a controlled substance. The state agrees that the evidence was insufficient to prove that he was guilty of either count of selling controlled substances. Because the evidence was insufficient to prove the charged offenses, this court must reverse Pratt's convictions and direct the district court to enter a judgment of acquittal. But rather than reversing the convictions, the state asserts this court should instead direct that Pratt be convicted of offenses with which he was never charged. This court must not, because doing so would violate his rights guaranteed by three separate sources of law. The Due Process Clause.
He was found guilty of first degree. There was no adjudication on third degree. Is that right?
There was no finding of guilt on the third degree. That's right.
Okay.
That's right. So the fact that this court must direct a judgment of acquittal at the district court is guaranteed by three separate sources of law: the Due Process Clause, the Double Jeopardy Clause, and Minnesota.
We shouldn't have to spend any time on that. The state concedes that, does it not?
The state concedes that the evidence was insufficient to prove sale.
Right. And right. So we shouldn't argue about why we would not reverse that.
Mm-hmm. I agree that the conviction should be reversed, and the state agrees that the conviction should be reversed. The state's argument is that he should be convicted of a different crime. And so I would agree that this court shouldn't spend much time considering that issue, because I don't think that there's a constitutional or statutory basis for this court to convict him of a different uncharged offense. Considering
rule,
the state's...
Rule 28 of the Rules of Criminal Procedure, I recall, gives us some direction of what we're supposed to do if we find that a conviction should be reversed. Is that correct?
Rule 28 does address what this court may do when it reverses a conviction, yes. So what Rule 28 does is it gives the court a few options, this court a few options, but it cabins those options to as the case may require. So what Rule 28 does is it says that this court can order a new trial or direct the judgment of acquittal at the district court, but says that those decisions should be made as the case may require. And because ordering... Rule 28 also says that this court could, if the case required it, order that the conviction be reduced to an offense of the same offense of a lesser degree or a lesser included offense. But the case requires that this court enter a judgment of acquittal because not doing so would violate the Constitution, and not doing so isn't even permitted by that rule, because what the state is requesting that his conviction be reduced to is not a lesser degree of the same offense or a lesser included offense of the offenses with which he was charged. And so though the rule does give this court the ability to address those options, this case requires that judgment of acquittal be entered to be in compliance with the Constitution and in compliance with that rule.
Clearly, we would not have a lesser degree. Would we have an included offense?
No, not in this situation. That's because the offense that the state, the uncharged offense that the state is requesting that this court reduce the conviction to, is possession of a controlled substance. And Mr. Pratt was charged generally, broadly, with sale of a controlled substance. The complaint doesn't specifically charge him with possession with intent to sell. It charges him with broadly sale of a controlled substance, and the complaint specifically says that the state will prove that he sold a controlled substance as that's defined in the drug laws. The way that sale is defined in the drug laws broadly includes conduct that does not constitute possession of a controlled substance. You can be guilty under the drug laws, under the specific subdivision defining sale, you are guilty of sale of a controlled substance if you merely offer or agree to sell a controlled substance.
So your argument is that you could be convicted of a sale without ever being in possession?
That is, I believe that that's clearly required, that that result is clear under the definition of sale, that offering or agreeing to sell a controlled substance under 15201, subdivision 15, I believe it is, that defines a sale, provides that you can be convicted of a sale without ever possessing a controlled substance.
So your view is that we look at the elements that have to be the same if we're talking about an included, a lesser and included, and since possession is not an element of the first degree, it fails. Is that what you're arguing here?
Exactly, yes. I do think that one route that this court could take to resolve this is to recognize that Mr. Pratt was not charged specifically with possession with intent to sell. The complaint makes no specific reference to that subdivision defining. The complaint charges him generally with every single different way of selling a controlled substance, which there are many in 152.01 subdivision 15. If the state, for instance, had charged him specifically with possession with intent to sell, if the complaint had referenced that specific subdivision of the statute, if the complaint had if the complaint had specifically alleged that that was the theory of guilt, in that specific circumstance, possession might be a lesser included offense. But in this case, the state charged him broadly with sale, and As you just pointed out, you do not need to possess a controlled substance to be guilty of selling it.
Possession with intent to sell, that's a possession offense and not a sale offense, is it?
No, sale is defined.
No, don't start there. Answer the question. If possession with intent to sell, is that a sale offense under the definitions, or is it a possession offense?
If you are guilty of possession with intent to sell, you are guilty of a sale.
Okay. So it is within the definition of a sale to be in possession with intent to sell.
It is one way of committing a sale crime. In this case, the state charged Mr. Pratt with every single way of committing a sale crime. And to determine whether it's a lesser included offense, you have to compare, and this is clear case law from Lori Gisege, the United States Supreme Court, that to determine whether an offense is a lesser included offense of another offense, you look at the two, at the how the offense is defined by the elements, and it's not a lesser included offense if it is possible to commit the lesser offense or to commit the greater offense without committing the lesser offense. In this case, if you compare the two elements of the two offenses, it is possible, which is what you have to do to determine whether it's lesser included offense, it is possible to commit the offense he was charged with, sale of a controlled substance, without committing the second degree offense the state wants his conviction to be reduced to. That's because it's possible to commit a sale without possessing a controlled substance.
Mr. Lozo, I want to ask you a question. In the state's brief, in the conclusion, it's on page 23, it says, Pratt's conviction for first-degree possession of a controlled substance with intent to sell should be reduced. I mean, based on your argument, I'm looking at Judge Flerke's order. I mean, he was not convicted of possession with intent to sell.
Correct? No, he was convicted of a sale.
Okay, this is an incorrect statement in the brief.
Yes.
That subdivision.
Yeah, he was, if the judge's order, his conclusion of law, not appropriately because the evidence was insufficient, but the only offense he was ever charged with was the sale of a controlled substance. The only offense that the court found him guilty and convicted him of was sale of a controlled substance. He was never charged specifically with possession.
That part of the definition of possession with intent to sell, which is also a sale offense, that subdivision, was it included in the complaint at any point so that you would be clearly on notice that that was one of the theories that the state had?
No, that subdivision was never referenced in the complaint, and the complaint, when it's offering the narrative version of the offense with which he is charged, cites every possible way of selling a controlled substance.
I recall the criminal rules also require the court to make findings before there's a conviction. Did the court make those kind of findings here?
The court's findings replicate the facts to which the parties stipulated, which the state has conceded.
Just recited the stipulation of facts, didn't make findings on the elements of the crime.
That's right.
And so there's no finding by the trial court that the trial court's finding of a sale is based on possession with intent to sell.
That's right.
Okay.
So that's right. So yeah, the court's findings aren't specific to that way of proving the offense, and the court's conclusion of law is that he's guilty of the sale offense generally. So just to go, because of that fact, because he was charged with a sale offense that is of which possession is not lesser included, the due process clause would not allow his conviction to be reduced. Under the rules of criminal procedure, his conviction can't be reduced. I think it's also important to point out that because of that fact, and with any conviction that's reversed on acquittal, the double jeopardy clause also would operate here. That a finding of insufficient evidence by this court has been determined by the United States Supreme Court, by the Minnesota Supreme Court, specifically to be an acquittal for double jeopardy purposes. The only just remedy, this is from versus United States, is entry of judgment of acquittal.
Are you saying then that the rule violates the double jeopardy clause?
I'm saying that you certainly don't need to find that in this case. It's possible that it could. But the way that the rule is written right now, because of the lesser included offense, the fact that this is possession is not a lesser included offense, you certainly don't need to address that or find that in this case. That provision of the rule could violate that, but it's not a necessary decision for this court to make in this case. And again, I want to emphasize that in this case, I don't think that there's any need for the court to break any new ground at all, to do anything particularly complicated. I think that all this court needs to do is look at what he was specifically charged with, what he was specifically found guilty and convicted of, and as case law requires, to assess the elements of those two offenses and to determine that possession in this case with these charges and this finding of guilt is not a lesser included offense.
Do we have any case law that discusses a statute which is like our sale statute, which has so many different ways of committing the offense, and the impact that that broad definition has on determining what might be a lesser included?
Well, I would direct this court's attention to two cases, one of which is cited a couple times in my brief. It's State v. Gisege, I think is how it's pronounced. And in that case, the question was whether the defendant could be convicted of assault as a lesser included offense of attempted murder. And one of the things that the court looked at in that case that I think is really important is it specifically stated, in accordance with case law, that when determining whether it's a lesser included offense, what the court does is looks at the elements of the two offenses, the charged offense and the purported lesser offense, to determine if you can commit the greater offense without committing the lesser offense. The court points that out. And I think that something that's really interesting about that case is that the court points out in that case, in determining that assault is not a lesser included offense of attempted murder, is that the elements don't require you, it was assault one, elements don't require you for attempted murder to inflict great bodily harm. The court stated, in this case, great bodily harm was inflicted. There's no doubt about that. But because the elements of the offenses don't require that, because you can commit attempted murder without inflicting great bodily harm, this is not a lesser included offense. Another case that I would point the court's attention to that's similar logically is State versus Johnson. On rebuttal, I'll get you the specific citation for that because there's a lot of Johnsons, but State versus Johnson, which was a burglary case where the state was arguing that even if the evidence was insufficient, there's another subdivision of the statute under which the jury could have found guilt. And what the court, even though a lesser included offense wasn't at issue there, it was a different way of committing the same offense. What the court concluded there was because that subdivision of the statute was not argued to the jury as a basis of guilt, because that was not given to the jury as a jury instruction, that the evidence, even if it could have supported that, that the conviction couldn't be supported on that basis, because that wasn't the state's theory of guilt, that wasn't what was argued to the jury, that wasn't what was presented to the jury, and even if that subdivision of the statute would make him guilty, that on sufficiency review, the court wasn't going to permit the conviction to be sustained on that basis, on a different subdivision that was never at issue in the case. So unless this court has other questions, I'll cede the rest of my less than a minute and respond on rebuttal.
You have a question?
Could I ask you,
yes.
The charge of possession with intent to sell, which statute is that?
So there is no specific offense of possession with intent to sell. What Mr. Pratt was charged with was sale of a controlled substance. Sale for purposes of the drug law, and sale for purposes of the drug law, and I'll get you that citation right now, is defined in Minnesota Statutes 152.01, subdivision 15A. I'm sorry, I misspoke before. I said 15. It's 15A. Which provides all the different ways that someone can sell a controlled substance under the meaning of the statute, including to offer or agree to sell it, which is why possession is not a lesser included.
Okay, and I just want to follow up because your argument is basically that he wasn't charged with this possession with intent to sell. But doesn't the complaint, can't you construe the complaint as that being a description of what occurred here, even though, because there isn't a statute that applies, right?
I think it's important to be clear here. So if the evidence had been sufficient, if at trial the state had presented sufficient evidence that he possessed with intent to sell, he would have been guilty of a sale. But the reason that this court can't order reduction of his conviction on remand rather than just judgment of acquittal is because he was charged with sale generally rather than specifically only with possession with intent to sell, possession is not a lesser included offense of sale because there are lots of ways to commit a sale, including ones that don't require him to ever possess a controlled substance. So under the way the complaint was charged, broadly, sale. Mr. Pratt sold drugs. If there had been sufficient evidence of that fact, he could have been found guilty. But because the evidence was insufficient, this court cannot direct that he be convicted of a possession offense because the complaint didn't specifically charge him with something that requires him to possess a controlled substance.
Anything further? I think so. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lozo.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
Thank you. Again, please the court. Gary Bjorkman, St. Louis County Attorney's Office, representing the respondent, State of Minnesota. First, I'd just like to comment about how the complaint was charged. The complaint was charged under the provision 152.012, subdivision 1, which is basically sale. It comes up sale as more than 10 or more grams of heroin. The term sale is defined in 152.01. The problem with the complaint, and it includes the language possession with intent, that's right in the description of what the charge is against him. But the problem with the complaint and the charging is e-charging does not give you the option to refer back to the sale definitions. So you have no other choice than an e-charging than to charge it as a, quote, sale, which also includes possession with intent. And that language is in the description of what the alleged acts are. And if you read the probable cause statement, it's crystal clear the defendant had notice that he's being charged with possession with intent under that theory. So some of the argument the counsel is making for respondent, the state can't do anything different because that's not an option in e-charging.
I guess I'm trying to understand too. There's no statute that says that there's a charge for possession with intent to sell. It's just
that is correct.
So if you're going to make that charge for a sale, you're going to have to do it as part of the complaint. Am I correct on that?
You have to do it as part of the complaint, and it has to come up in e-charging under the sale statute, and then the intent to possession with intent to sell is part of the definition that is then instructed to the jury at the time of trial. But there is no separate charge for possession with intent. That is considered a sale under the statute and under the law.
Did the trial court make findings here that there was possession with intent to sell? And therefore a sale?
The trial court made a finding that he was guilty of the charge of the complaint, which is sale of heroin. He made findings that the heroin was found on the defendant's person. And this was a stipulated facts trial where the defendant stipulated that the heroin was found on his person. So he made findings of fact about the drugs being found on the person, but the actual conviction mirrored what the language was in the complaint.
So then isn't that a sufficient basis for count one to remain? Why did you concede on count one then?
Because count one, we would have to prove possession with intent. And even though we had discussions off the record what was going to be stipulated to, I basically screwed up and did not make sure certain things referred to on the record as far as the intent to sell. But the record is clearly sufficient to show that he possessed more than maybe 6 grams of cocaine for the second degree offense.
The issue here is whether or not this is a lesser and included offense.
Your Honor, it's my position it is, because the statute defines several ways an offense can be a lesser included offense. And the first one is a lesser degree of the same crime. And Minnesota has set up a tiered system for drugs, first, second, third, fourth, and fifth, just like they have for murder, first, second, and third, and just like they have for assaults, first, second, third, fourth, and fifth. Now, there's no case law that talks about all these being considered lesser included offenses on the drug side, but if you look at case law on the assault statutes and on the murder statutes, there's many cases that say that is the intent of the legislature when they put up the tiered system and put them in degrees. So by definition, it would be a lesser included offense.
So you're saying that possession is a lesser, by reason of the statute having degrees, a lesser of first degree sale?
Yes, I am, Your Honor. And, in the one case, the state versus, it's NYAGWOKI. That's Northwest 2nd, 894-174, 2017 case, which basically says on the assault statute, it's the same thing. It's a tiered statutory scheme with 5 degrees, and they go through the statutes 1 through 5 and say that by statute they're lesser included offenses. And there are several ways you can commit assault in the fourth degree or the third degree and not commit assault in the first degree. The impossibility argument doesn't fit if it's listed as a degree under the definitions. It's common sense. If you had a trial for a person in possession, charged with possession of intent with intent to sell, and either counsel asked for the lesser included after trial of just plain possession, the court's going to have to grant it because it's a lesser degree and the facts would support it. To rule otherwise would take away that option to both the state and the defendant. Second degree is a lesser included offense of first degree on the drug statutes.
Well, you could charge him in count pleadings and make sure that it's in front of everyone as well, couldn't you?
Yes, you could. You could count it, I guess, in multiple counts. A lot of times that's not done.
You did first and third, but you didn't do possession. Is that right?
Well, the third degree had to deal with cocaine that was found on him. That was a different drug, yes, totally.
Okay. All right.
But you could multiple count it, but if it's a lesser included offense, you don't have to. In general practice, a lot of prosecutors, we don't do that, because the statute doesn't require it.
Well, if you do it, it then goes to the jury as a potential as well, does it not?
It would go to the jury as a potential lesser, or either side, if the facts allowed and supported, could ask the judge to submit the lesser included offense of second degree.
And nobody asked the judge here, since this was a court trial, to consider
Nobody made that request, Your Honor, because I think a lot of people in the courtroom made a mistake on the record as to what we're going to submit. So that was not done. No. The due process argument and the double jeopardy argument. You know, due process is basically a notice requirement of what you're being charged with. You get the opportunity to defend it and to make sure that all the elements are proven. This defendant had sufficient due process notice of what he is being charged with, possession of more than 10 grams of heroin with intent to sell. And this is a lesser included offense of possession of 6 grams. As long as the lesser included offense, the due process argument fails. The double jeopardy argument, again, I mean, counsel cited a couple cases in his brief. One, I believe, was, remember, it was Burke. The other one was, in a footnote, he cited Johnson from South Carolina and suggested that Johnson basically adopted this double jeopardy argument for remanding to a sentence on a lesser. If you read Johnson, it does not do that. In fact, Johnson acknowledges that the indicta of the U.S. Supreme Court in Rutledge versus United States, that's 116 Supreme Court, 124, resolved the issue of this double jeopardy constitutional issue on remands for sentencing when a court vacates a major sentence and then goes back and has it remanded for sentencing on a lesser included offense.
Well, counsel, for the appellant suggests that if we would take your acquiescence on the first degree count and enter judgment of acquittal, that would create the double jeopardy issue. So can that issue be avoided by not entering a judgment of acquittal, but simply remanding for the trial court to consider, in your view, the lesser and included possession and a sentence on that?
Your Honor, I think that's 100% correct. We're not asking for a judgment of acquittal. You know, we're asking that the court remand with the direction to enter the conviction on the lesser and then resentence accordingly. Now, we concede the evidence is not sufficient. However, there is clearly sufficient evidence in the record and in the court's findings, and the evidence that was stipulated by the defendant at trial to find all the elements of the lesser included offense there and acknowledged on the record. So that's what we're asking the court to do, to remand, direct the court to enter a conviction on the lesser and resentence accordingly.
Appellant also argues that there was an illegal arrest or illegal detention or both. Didn't, at least in the briefs, didn't get a chance to do it orally. Do you want to comment on any of that?
Well, I think I commented pretty well in my brief, but okay. Yeah, at some point, you know, this is another argument that wasn't expressly put before the trial court. You look at the defense counsel notice of issues that he was going to raise. It was going to be PC for the search warrant. Suppression of evidence as the fruit of a poisonous tree, but doesn't allege its illegal arrest. And then the statements, which never argued later, he never talked about illegal arrest in his brief. His whole argument was that the police pretextually arrested the co-defendant over force at a time when they could then search the vehicle and detain his client. As a result of that, they found the drugs inside the vehicle next to the defendant where he had been sitting. He never once used any argument that the arrest was illegal. It was all focused on getting the drugs that were found inside the vehicle suppressed. And if you read the whole thing, I mean, it's pretty clear once the drugs were found, the police had PC to arrest the defendant at that point.
And your argument is that prior to that time, they had reasonable articulable suspicion based upon what was going down and his movements in the vehicle.
Sounds right. That's right. They had reasonable suspicion he was involved. They had a person inside the vehicle they were going to arrest, and then they saw his additional movements. At that point, you know, they had a right to detain him, ask him of the vehicle. He wasn't cooperative, and during that process, he was basically getting rid of drugs that was on his person.
At what point in this process, focusing on taking him out of the vehicle and cuffing him and seeing what the officers believed to be drugs near where he was seated, Which came first? The seeing the drugs or putting them in cuffs?
What came, it's very fluid. It all happened within seconds or less. I mean, he was taken from the vehicle. Two officers, when they turned, he was handcuffed, put on the ground. At the simultaneous that happened, the other officer looked back in his vehicle and saw the drugs. Okay. Initially, they were going to detain him for investigation and for safety reasons because of his furtive movements and the fact he was not being cooperative. But it happened almost simultaneous. It's at least one really one fluid. But the point they saw the drugs at that point, it's clear they had PC to arrest him for possession of drugs. And the fact that he dumped the drugs in the vehicle before they took him out, that was nothing to do with any alleged illegal arrest. That happened before he was taken out of the vehicle, before he would have been put on the ground, before he would have been handcuffed.
Wait for your time.
Any further questions? Nothing else from the court at this time, Mr. Bjorklund.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
But you can certainly conclude if you wish. You have a minute and a half left. But
well, I just want to conclude that, you know, they talked about the charged offense a little bit. What was charged? What was charged? The charged offense was actually possession with intent to sell. It comes up sale because e-charging makes it come up that way. But if you look at the complaint in its whole, the description and the probable cause, the charged offense was actually possession with intent to sell. And even aside from the second degree being a lesser by the statute because it's a lower degree of the same offenses, it also would be a lesser under the charged offense because the way it's charged, possession with intent, straight possession would also be a lesser included offense.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Lozo, do you have rebuttal?
I do, thank you.
So, counsel analogizes the drug scheme of the various degrees to assault with various degrees, and he cites us to a case that he says Minnesota Supreme Court said that that means that those various degrees of assault are lesser offenses, and he says with that same theory should apply here. Your response, please.
I disagree that a sale, that the possession of drugs is the same offense as the sale of drugs. They plainly require different conduct. I think that under the assault statutes, different degrees, lesser degrees of higher, an assault three may constitute an assault one if you can commit the, if you can't commit the assault one without committing the assault three. I think that the reason that lesser degree of the same offense and an offense necessarily proved if the greater is proved doesn't mean that you can affirm a conviction on the basis of some offense that's not necessarily proved. I think it's two different ways of getting at an assault one versus an assault three. If the assault one is necessarily if the assault three is necessarily proved in the assault one, or if it was a different crime with a different name. I don't know off the top of my head the case that counsel refers to, but I don't think that it's a lesser included offense just because it's a different degree of the same offense with the same name. Another thing that I want to point out is that counsel refers to the problem as being e-charging. We had to refer to this as sale generally, charging with every way of selling drugs. But we had to do that because of the programs we use. Setting aside whether that's a constitutional argument or not,
he says in addition, however, the probable cause portion of the complaint clearly spells out the possession with intent to sell.
Well, I disagree that this court, when determining whether it's a lesser included offense, should look at all at the facts of what was ever alleged or even what was proven. The fact is that the reason that we're arguing about how the state charged this out is because the state did not prove its case, is because the state provided insufficient evidence that Mr. Pratt sold drugs. Because of that, this court needs to look at the offense charged to determine constitutionally whether the conviction can be reduced. And I do agree to a reference that Judge Klopaki made to my initial argument, that if this court were to conclude that it's a lesser degree of the same offense or something like that, which obviously I don't think that it should, that then there would be a double jeopardy argument, because the double jeopardy case law is clear that a finding of insufficient evidence is a judgment of acquittal on the merits. It represents a factual resolution of the case, and that the defendant can't be subject to further proceedings prosecuting him at the district court. I think that that's also required by 609.035 and 609.04, the statutes that bar prosecution upon an earlier conviction or acquittal. I also do want to, in the last minute or two here, unless there are other questions on that, to refer to a couple questions regarding the suppression argument. First of all, counsel argued that this was not argued at the district court, that this was forfeited at the district court. To my memory, I don't have it directly in front of me, but at least a couple references in the brief to counsel's brief, suppression brief at the district court, to fruit being suppressed because of the arrest of Pratt. It's in my reply brief. There was specific argument that there was not probable cause, as counsel put it, to detain him, but probable cause is the standard for arrest rather than detention. Regarding that also, I just want to be clear that I believe, and I cited it in my brief, that the record is clear that the drugs inside the car were seen after Mr. Pratt was arrested, after he was pulled out of the van, set on the ground, and handcuffed. I think that the record is clear on that. And I also wanted to address one further point, that even if Mr. Pratt, and the record is not clear on how the drugs ended up on the floor of the car, but even if it were true that he dropped them or mishandled them or something in response to the police's action of arresting him, that what matters is not whether he abandoned them, but what matters, or dropped them or whatever, but what matters is whether the police discovered those drugs as a fruit of the illegal arrest. Abandonment isn't at issue if police discover the drugs as the fruit of illegal conduct. So in the last 15 seconds, I'd like to ask if there are other questions.
There is.
Yes.
You know, one thing, you're making the argument that in this case, there would be double jeopardy to have to retry the case. But in that, possession in this case was front and center. And in fact, the judge has specific findings that there was possession. And in that, the judge based those findings upon what was the stipulated facts of your client. How could this be double jeopardy when the only thing, there isn't going to be a retrial. It's just the judge has already tried it. He's already made these findings. And the only issue is whether it's a lesser included. And since it's a possession with intent to sell, the possession that was front and center during the whole trial, how could this be double jeopardy? I would understand the double jeopardy argument if there is a retrial or something related to a sale. But how would that apply to possession?
Well, a few quick responses to that. First of all, I think that while the evidence may have been sufficient for possession with intent to sell, if the evidence was not sufficient for possession with intent to sell, excuse me, I misspoke there. But possession, you're right, was at issue in the proceedings, but also at issue in the proceedings was whether there was this drug distribution conspiracy going on. So, of course, the court did make a finding that Mr. Pratt possessed these drugs, but I don't think that was the only thing at issue in the proceedings. Second of all, the double jeopardy argument is independent from the lesser included argument. Looking at the court's finding and saying, oh, he made a finding that Mr. Pratt possessed drugs, he can be reconvicted, that double jeopardy argument is independent from whether it's a lesser included offense. And finally, I would say there isn't going to be a new trial if this court orders that, but there will be a new proceeding where Mr. Pratt is found guilty and convicted of an offense that he was not charged with. And that's what would violate double jeopardy. Whether that proceeding is contested or not, the district court has to vacate the present convictions, implicitly or explicitly find him guilty of other offenses and convict him of those offenses and then resentence him, presumably.
But you'll agree the court can do that without retrying.
Certainly, there, whatever the resolution of this case is, there won't need to be a new trial.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
And there shouldn't be.
Thank you, Mr. Lozo. And thank you, Mr. Bjorklund.
Thank you.
Matter's been submitted.